coming up on this week's mini episode of the Drew Perowit Podcast.
If you're getting fatigued after you eat and really, really tired, which, by the way, is not normal, you have some insulin surges, and that's going to create some devastating physiological shifts in your brain, which are not healthy.
Have you ever gone to your doctor for your normal annual physical, and after sitting with them for 10 minutes, they quickly look at your labs and tell you, hey, everything looks normal. Keep it up, and I'll see you again next year. Maybe even give you a nice little pat on the back. I can't tell you how many listeners of the podcast have told me that they've had this exact experience and how, honestly, how frustrating it can be. Now, we all know that normal isn't always optimal. Just because something's not wrong doesn't mean that we feel great. So traditional medicine is great at finding out when something is blatantly wrong, but they don't always do the best job when we need to highlight how we can do better. So what if you could get detailed nutritional and lifestyle guidance based on your individual needs? That's what Inside Tracker does. Inside Tracker was founded in 2009 by top scientists from acclaimed universities in the field of aging, genetics, and biometrics. Its mission is to help people live long, healthy, productive lives by optimizing their bodies from the inside out. Inside Tracker is cutting-edge technology, and it looks at your blood, DNA, lifestyle, and it has fitness tracker data, and they give you science-backed recommendations for positive changes to your daily habits. It's all about the daily habits. With their app, you can track your progress every day, and they have an amazing support team to help you with any questions you might have. Inside Tracker looks at everything from metabolic and inflammatory markers to top nutrients and hormones. It even tests your cholesterol levels to help you better manage stress, and you have the option to see how your inner age compares to your chronological age. Traditional lab tests can be hard to read on your own, but Inside Tracker makes their results easy to understand and even provides tips on how to use food first for optimal nutrition. Right now, Inside Tracker is offering my podcast community 25% off their system. Just go to insidetracker.com/Drew. That's DHRU to get your discount code and try it out for yourself. That's Inside Tracker, INSIDE Tracker, TRACKER.com/Drew, DHRU for your 25% off. This episode is brought to you by Cozy Earth. What happens when your favorite bedding company starts making the most comfortable loungewear in the world? I'll tell you what happens. An explosion of joy and relaxation in every cell in your body. If you're looking for super comfortable and stylish men's and women's pajamas, joggers, robes, pullovers, and hoodies, my personal favorite, basically all the stuff that we're wearing working from home these days, Cozy Earth has you covered. So what's Cozy Earth's not so secret fabric that powers their superior comfort? It's the miracle plant bamboo. The more I've learned about bamboo, the more I've fallen in love with it. Bamboo is just as soft as silk, but it's way more durable, which means you can wash it without worrying about destroying the quality. Bamboo is incredibly breathable, so it doesn't trap heat, which is key, especially for pajamas at night, and the support with temperature regulation. Nobody likes getting too hot or too cold at night. And bamboo is way better for the earth. It's sustainable, it lasts longer, and requires way less processing than cotton and other fabrics that are out there that are ruining our environment. If you're ready to make the upgrade to ultra soft, healthy for you and healthy for the planet, super stylish loungewear that you can wear both inside the home and the outside, it's time to give Cozy Earth a try. Right now, they're offering my community their highest discount ever. Listen to this, 40% off. Just go to CozyEarth.com with the discount code DrewPodcast. That's Cozy, C-O-Z-Y, Earth, E-A-R-T-H.com with the code DHRU Podcast, P-O-D-C-A-S-T. Check it out today. Keep in mind, by the way, that Cozy Earth has a 10-year warranty, so you really can't go wrong with giving them a try. Hi, everyone. Drew Perowit here. For a long time, brain fatigue and the lack of cognitive endurance were just considered a normal part of aging. These issues are actually symptoms of a much larger problem, though. Neuroinflammation. Say it with me. Neuroinflammation. And they aren't inevitable, contrary to what you've been told. On today's mini episode, I speak with Dr. Datis Karazian and my friend Sean Stevenson about the top things that are damaging our brain and the earliest signs of neuroinflammation, and most importantly, how you can protect and optimize your brain function. Let's listen in, starting with Dr. Datis Karazian, who is a Harvard Medical School trained and award-winning clinical research scientist, academic professor, and world-renowned functional medicine healthcare provider. He develops evidence-based models to treat autoimmune, neurological, and unidentified chronic diseases with non-pharmaceutical applications. His clinical models of evidence-based medicine are used by several academic institutions and thousands of healthcare providers throughout the world. So let's start at the beginning. Break down just that word, neuroinflammation, and help us understand what are the primary drivers today in our modern day society that is causing this neuroinflammation in the body.
Okay, sure. So when you look at the brain, or look at any tissue, there's cells in there. And with the brain as a tissue, there's two types of cells in the brain. One are called neurons, which everyone's familiar with, which causes synapses and allows you to think and have emotions and all the things you probably know what the brain does. But the other cell in the brain is called the neuroglia. And glia is a Latin term for glue. And they thought the initial function of these cells was just to glue the neurons together, but it's actually found to be very, very metabolically active. So there's different types of neuroglia, but the point is that these neuroglia cells are in our brain, and one of their main jobs is to get rid of debris. So as we get older and as our normal neurons start to die off, they have to be cleaned up. That debris and that those dead cells meant to be cleaned up. So the neuroglia normally go in there and they clean that debris up. And then also just from normal physiological function of the brain, we get some proteins that stick around for a while. These are things like alpha-synuclein, beta-amyloid, and then the glia clears those up. What happens in neurodegenerative diseases is this cleaning up process doesn't take place. And this cleaning up process is known as autophagy or mitophagy. They're just how the brain cleans up debris. And in what happens in neurodegenerative diseases is these inflammatory reactions lose their ability to clear out these proteins, and they actually shift in creating inflammation in the brain where it helps promote more of these proteins. So it does like the opposite thing. So when you look at every single neurodegenerative disease, or you look at head trauma, you know, when those things impact the brain, it's really through these neuroglial cells. They're actually injuring neurons in the area, and they are leading to inability to get rid of these debris. So what triggers that? That's the question, the second part of your question. So they're triggered by brain injury. They're triggered by air pollution. Lots of studies now linking air pollution in different communities to dementia, Alzheimer's disease. This is the pulmonary neuroglia axis. We already talked about adipocyte glial axis. There's the microbiome neuroglia axis, where the things we eat, the food, that things that are inflammatory in our gut can turn on these neuroglial cells. There's the pulmonary barrier neuroglia axis, where infections and things we have in our lungs can turn on these glial cells in the brain. And any part of our immune system that gets activated, for whatever the mechanisms may be, can also turn on these inflammatory reactions in the brain. And the problem with that is the brain doesn't have a healthy anti-inflammatory antioxidant system. So there's very little antioxidants in the brain. And when this inflammatory process turns on in the brain, it really causes loss of function. And in the early stages, so, you know, when you look at brain inflammation, neuroinflammation, and neurodegenerative disease, it doesn't just go from you have the disease and you don't have the disease. It goes through stages. So the very first stage of brain inflammation is brain fatigue, brain endurance issues. So people just start to notice when these pathways turn on is they can't read like they used to read as much as they used to. Is they, you know, they maybe used to sat down and read 10 chapters or an hour, now they can barely get through one. They can't drive as long as they used to. Driving really is taxing for them. They have to take breaks. Everything they do just that's cognitive, it requires their brain, just doesn't have as much endurance. So that's the first sign. And then it goes into
which by the way, if I could interrupt for a second, sure. A lot of people attribute to just old age. Hey, I'm getting older. I can't focus as much, or I can't see as well when I'm driving or drive as long. But what you're really talking about is that, sure, this might be increasing over a period of time, but is it the age or is it the inflammation that's the driver behind this?
Exactly. So let's listen, we're all going to lose some degree of cell function as we get older. but you should be able to read, you should be able to drive, you should be able to do things you were doing within a reasonable amount of time. And, you know, when we get older, there's also the possibility for neuroplasticity, where our neuron connections get much more efficient and much faster, and we're able to engage in things much more efficiently. So it really goes in the balance. Now, most people in the population have more neuroinflammation, neuroplasticity over time, so they just notice their brain function goes down. But then there's others that their neuroplasticity, their neurons connecting together and staying healthy are working at a higher degree than their brain inflammation. So as they get, you know, older and older, their brain function improves. I can tell you my brain function now at almost 50 is much, much, much better than it was when I was 20. Just because of connectivity, plasticity, using my brain, you know, doing all the things I do with it for my cognitive tasks are completely different. And hopefully in the next 10 years, I can keep my neuroinflammation down and keep my neuroplasticity up so I can maintain high level of function as my career matures. You know, and as a healthcare provider, as an educator, as a researcher, you know, you got to save your brain. Same thing with many professions.
So you were mentioning earlier some of the signs that somebody's brain might literally be on the fire from the inside out, right? That's what we're really talking about, is neuroinflammation is basically, it's a version of your brain and your body being on fire and that causing all this debris, which we'll come back to in a minute. So one sign is you can't focus for as long as you used to. You can't read anymore. You feel very sort of distracted or agitated. You can't maintain that. Another example is you gave, you may not be able to drive for long periods of time. What are some other, whether they're things that people notice or whether they're diagnosable conditions that are linked and connected to neuroinflammation?
Okay, great. So as far as diagnosable conditions, I mean, a general one is like general fatigue syndrome. Like, so when the brain is fatigued, the whole body is fatigued, right? So one of the things that sometimes people get diagnosed with chronic fatigue, you know, as an example. And as a clinician, I always ask the question, what are the things that cause your fatigue? And they say, if they say things like, well, driving causes, when you really break it down with them and driving and doing cognitive tasks really causes fatigue. And they might say, you know, on the weekends, it's not so bad, but on the weekends, I'm not on my computer all day at work. I'm not engaging with people. I'm just getting a chance to rest. That's a big sign that that the chronic fatigue is really, you know, early neuroinflammation, neurodegeneration. And another common diagnosis that takes place with neuroinflammation is just depression. So in the world of psychiatry, you know, and neurology, the focus for many years was on a neurotransmitter problem. So like your serotonin was low, your dopamine is low, and then you would take like a serotonin reuptake inhibitor or another kind of neurotransmitter stimulating medication. But now there's a huge trend in the research, which is really focused on, and I think the next level, which is the cytokine model of depression or the inflammatory model of depression. So when there's a lot of inflammation in the brain, nerve conductance or nerve speed slows down. And when that happens in areas of the brain called the cingulate gyrus, prefrontal cortex, people get depressed. So,
whereas previously the understanding and sort of the model of depression, can you contrast thus to sort of what people understood in the medical world of what they thought was driving depression?
Yeah, well, what they thought was driving depression was like your serotonin was low and you would take something called like serotonin reuptake inhibitor and that would slow down your serotonin breakdown. The interesting thing is when they've looked at those medications have an initial anti-inflammatory effect. And then it stops having that effect. The immune system then takes over and the neuroglia don't adapt to that drug anymore for anti-inflammatory effect. And this is also what you see the clinical outcomes. When you look at someone taking a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, they notice that they have a honeymoon phase where that's great and it works well for them. And then as they take it longer, it doesn't. And part of the reason may be that it had nothing to do with the neurotransmitter itself, that it really was dampening the inflammatory response. And really their major cause of depression is brain inflammation. And then the brain inflammation may be linked to, like you said, insulin and diabetes or air pollution or their microbiome or really a combination of all these factors that's now shutting down their nerve speed because of the inflammation in the brain.
So let's continue down the pathway. And actually the one that you talked about, air pollution, is really interesting because right now, I mean, if you Google top 50 most polluted cities in the world, where I'm from in India, where I'm from, which is India, I was actually born in Kenya, but where I'm from originally, ancestry is India. India has, I think it's 11 of the top 50 most polluted cities. China has probably the rest. And then there's a few others sprinkled out throughout the world. What is this massive air pollution, which is not just a problem in India and China, it's becoming a problem here in the US as well and other places. What is that doing to our brain health?
Absolutely. I'll talk about, yeah, for sure. But let me just point out one other thing. Your air pollution can also be in your home. Like right. If you have really old carpet and you have your vents have never been clean, like the air quality in your home you live in every single day could be really, really poor, even though you maybe live in an area where it's not the top air pollution city, like, I don't know, like in India or China or Los Angeles or something. But but the key thing is, so that's something to be aware of too. Now, what happens with air pollution is very fascinating. There's two known mechanisms published on this. One of them is it activates your pulmonary immune system. Your lung has a barrier system just like your gut. And there's cells there called dendritic cells and macrophages. And then once those chemicals come in, they activate them. And that creates an inflammatory response. And those inflammatory messengers from the lung immune system turn on neuroglial cells in the brain. Another mechanism is directly through our nasal passage pathways that our nerve sensors, our olfactory nerve, connect with our olfactory bulb and have direct connections into the brain. So when our smell receptors get exposed to these pollutants, that drives the inflammatory chemical response all the way through our smell pathways into our brain. And these smell pathways, by the way, really go to an area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is the first site of Alzheimer's disease degeneration. And there are numerous studies now called epidemiological type research where they find direct findings of MRI degeneration correlated with air pollution, like scary levels of statistical association. And so we're probably getting some inflammation activating directly through neurons, through our nasal passages into our brain, and also through our lung respiratory pathways. But the air we breathe is really, really impactful. And also looking at apps now that can measure the amount of particulate, small pollutants in the air. And they've also published studies where they can look at the air quality of those days and see different, they can do cognitive tests with people and it changes. And they've also published studies where they take office buildings, improve ventilation, so these particulate matters aren't around, and the work performance changes. So it's like immediate, has an immediate impact on brain. So it's pretty fascinating stuff.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because we tend to think of cities being polluted, but I believe it was in the mid-80s, the EPA did a study. We'll link to it in the show notes. I don't have the exact year. And they found that indoor air quality could be up to 300 times more polluted and more particulates than outdoor air quality. And it's just another great reminder that there's so many things inside the home, whether that be, as you mentioned, carpet, air vents, could be mold toxicity that people have floating around inside of their home and sort of, these byproducts that mold put out there, these cytokines that trigger a cytokine response. So there's so many things even inside of our home. So let me just ask you, since we're on this topic, what do you do? What does the doctor himself do to try to maintain a healthier indoor air quality?
So there's a few things that I've done in my home to ensure that we have the best air quality. First of all, you have to get a good home air filter. And it has to be a HEPA filter, H-E-P-A. Those are the only ones that really work. Studies have clearly shown that they get rid of these small particles and they can even get rid of mycotoxins, things in your air. And then different size HEPA filters account for different types of square footage. So you might have more than one in each of your rooms. Like right now, my right hand, I have a HEPA filter here, and I have one in every room of my home, and I have it in every room of my office. And it's just on, it's pretty silent, you can't hear it. And that's one way that clearly has been published in research to make a difference. I don't use carpet in my home. Carpet is just I just put everything wooden floors in my home. I try to make my home not just free of air pollution, but chemicals. So I use just natural wood, oil, polish, none of the chemicals in there. So I don't have that offload from formaldehydes and dust particles to stay in there. And then,
which is really interesting, because if I could just interrupt for a second, is that, you know, you come from a Iranian Persian background and I come from an Indian background. And, you know, whenever I visit, you know, India, or I have a lot of Persian friends, my fiance is Persian, they would always talk about how the homes in Iran or the homes in India, there's no carpet. Like, carpet is very much like an American thing. They would always have either concrete or sort of wood. And that's just one way of keeping the home cleaner. And by the way, on top of that, you're not wearing shoes inside of the house, which are going to bring in all these sorts of different particulates and also increase the pollution that's there.
Yeah. And then your air vents in your home are very important. But also, one of the most profound things published is really your circulation within your home. having actually healthy airflow through your home. So, and by the way, if you're like work, if you're sleeping in your room and your carpet is just giving a lot of offload, you don't even have toxic mold. You said toxic mold, but even just if you have mildew, which isn't necessarily like toxic mold, mildew is an air pollutant. This creates particles that can impact your health and breathing. So you have mildew, you have, you know, like stuff from carpet, you don't have good circulation in the air. Those things can really impact your brain and your lung brain access connection, especially if you're sleeping in your room every day for hours, or if you're working in your office every day for hours. So those are the things that we start with, because you can't change like the amount of air pollution in the city you live in too much. You have to, you know, you really, when things become clinical, it's like, what can we really do to impact a person's health right away? So we can't change air quality in the city they live in, but we can definitely change air quality in their home and in their bedroom. So we start with their, as a clinician, now we start with their bedroom and the office setting they're in, wherever they're working in the most, and try to get those areas cleaned up.
Yeah, there's a great TED talk about how plants and certain types of plants can be brought into the home. We'll link to in the show notes. That is a low-cost solution. Another low-cost solution for those that are in a place where maybe finances are tight, just like you said, air circulation, which often could be just opening the windows as much as you possibly can, getting that air to turn around. You know, not everybody can afford a filter. I'm lucky that I can. You obviously, you know, can too, but not everybody's in that situation. So just even opening the windows is sometimes enough to just get fresh air in and not have that stagnant air continuing to pollute your lungs, your body, and ultimately your brain.
Yep. And again, studies clearly show the amount of circulation airflow you have an immediate effect on cognitive function.
It's true. So. It's true. There's in our offices, although nobody's working from the office anymore, we use a device. I'm not affiliated with them in any way, but it's called Awair, AWAIR. And the interesting thing they do is that they give you alerts and they say, you know, the particulate count is going up. The chemical count is going up. It's going to be hard for you to focus. Please ventilate immediately. Like you get these alerts on your phone and it's just another reminder of like, this is real, you know? And this is why sometimes people say, I just don't feel that they may not equate it to, I don't feel inspired right now. I feel stuffy. I feel this, I feel that. It could sometimes be your environment and you just need to mix that environment up a little bit, maybe get in some fresh air. So I want to shift a little bit because, you know, we've talked about gluten, for example, and, you know, you've said before that gluten can be one of the most inflammatory foods for the brain. And just for those that are not familiar, you know, do you still believe that's true? And why is that true? If it is?
Yeah. So I do believe it's true. And I should say, we published a paper 2000, I can remember, about 5 years ago, 2014, 15, 16, or something around it. They're all kind of mixed together now. But we did publish the paper in Nutrients, and we took 400 healthy blood donors. And we wanted to see how many of them had antibodies to gluten and to milk protein, casein. And when you look at gluten, gluten is a protein, but this protein has many branches. There's this alpha gliadin, there's gamma gliadin, there's gluteomorphin, right? There's a glutenin, there's all different branches of gluten. So we tested them from all of them. When people get a blood test and measure gluten, they're only measuring alpha gliadin. So we wanted to measure all the different proteins of gluten. Same with milk. There's alpha casein, beta casein, milk butyrophilin. There's different proteins. So we took 400 people, healthy blood donors, no disease, no symptoms, nothing, and checked to see how many of them had antibodies to milk and wheat, right? So we found it was around 17% had a clearly high antibody immune response to them in a healthy population. I'm not talking about a patient with population with depression or brain fog or neurodegenerative disease, but a healthy population, right? No symptoms whatsoever. So it was about 15, 17%, depending on the protein, whether it was milk or gluten. And that was interesting. Okay, so that's more than we thought. And then we then checked antibodies to the brain for all those people, all 400 people. How many antibodies to what's called myelin-basic protein, myelooligodendrocytes, and we want to see, you know, what degree of neurological, not only pain, not just neurological inflammation, but neurological autoimmunity these people had. So the correlation, you know, there's when you look at correlations, something called R value, and like a one would be a perfect correlation, 1-to-1. If you have this, you have that. And we're getting R values of like 0.7, 0.8. Between gluten and neuroinflammatory markers, neurological autoimmune markers. And we published that paper showing like, even with people that are healthy, this is pretty prevalent. This is like brewing an underlying neurological disease. So I think it's very prevalent. I think a lot of people don't even know they have it, right? Some people also consume those food proteins on a regular basis, and they don't realize what their brain potential is, because all they know is what their brain is doing for them at that given time, right? So some people will go off inflammatory foods, and all of a sudden they go, oh my gosh, my brain endurance is different. I feel energized again. I feel like I can focus again. This is incredible. And that may take 2 or 3 weeks to happen. It's just not going to happen with one day of doing it, right? Because you got to get rid of the inflammation and the immune response for that. So I think it's much, much more prevalent than people think. Why does it happen? Well, one of the reasons it happens is because of molecular mimicry. The antibodies made against gliadin and gluten, and even against the lectin portion of wheat germ or gluten, are so the antibodies produced against those can bind to actual neurons. So when proteins share very similar amino acid sequences, it's called amino acid homology, then when you eat those foods, your immune system will create antibodies against them, but those antibodies can also attach to your own tissues that have similar proteins. And both casein and gluten have been shown to have molecular similarity to brain tissue. So there's a high degree of neuroinflammation that can be promoted just from that.
My next guest and good friend, Sean Stevenson, is the author of the international best-selling book, Sleep Smarter, and the creator of The Model Health Show, one of the top podcasts that are out there. Sean has been featured in Forbes, ESPN, Muscle and Fitness, New York Times, and many other major media outlets. He's also an in-demand keynote speaker, just in case anybody's listening and they want to hire them for their next keynote. Sean and I dive deep into the top foods that can restore the function of the blood-brain barrier and reduce neuroinflammation. Let's listen in.
This is one of the biggest issues that is not being talked about right now is neuroinflammation. And this is inflammation in the brain. And the crazy thing is, and we've talked about this before, but the brain itself doesn't have pain receptors. So you can't know when your brain is hurt until it's too late, oftentimes. Your brain can tell you about pain anywhere else, but it's very secretive of what's happening within itself. And one of the biggest drivers of neuroinflammation is obesity. If somebody is moving towards obesity, you know, they're significantly overweight, there's a high propensity towards, and this is from and you mentioned this earlier, the New York Academy of Sciences, the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences, these same researchers found that inflammation in the brain is a double-edged sword, because neuroinflammation in the brain is a causative agent in creating obesity, and obesity is a causative agent in creating neuroinflammation. And we just get into this vicious circle. One of the issues behind that is obviously our massive intake of sugar in our culture today, with the average person somewhere around 70 pounds of added sugar every year consumption. And your brain is like the sugar gates into the brain. The biggest express pass is for sugar. It's just how we evolved, but we did not evolve with this much sugar. That's the thing. So your brain will gladly confiscate half of the sugar that you take in from a meal. It'll just sop it right up, and it can create absolute havoc in the brain. So with that said, one of the things that starts to happen over time with our abnormal intake of sugar, our abnormal intake of low quality fats, our exposure to pesticides, herbicides, rodenticides, all these environmental chemicals, which there's tens of thousands released every year into our environment that are new, and even just this past year, new chemicals. The EPA actually has approved 40,000 chemicals that are able to be used in agricultural farming, right? So the process of agriculture, let me say this better. They have 40,000 chemicals approved to be used in pesticide formulation, pesticides, herbicides, rodenticides that are able to be used in our food supply. All right. So what happens is the breakdown of our blood-brain barrier. This is key. So when the blood-brain barrier starts to break down, that protective force, stuff starts getting into the brain that shouldn't be there. And it exacerbates this problem of neuroinflammation. Now, here's a food that can actually help to heal the blood-brain barrier. I couldn't believe this. I mean, I thought the food was good. There's a lot of good science around it, especially if we're looking at longevity. But when I saw this, it just blew my mind. And this was from researchers at Auburn University. And they published a study, groundbreaking new research, asserting that oleocanthal-rich extra virgin olive oil is able to restore the function of the blood-brain barrier, right? Oleocanthal-rich extra virgin olive oil can actually heal and repair the blood-brain barrier. There's something about that fat. There's something about that food that literally heals the protective force, the protective mechanism in the brain. All right. Now, I want to highlight a couple of important points here. So some of the data digs in further, you know, the monounsaturated fats in there appear to be very brain friendly and even have some protective effects at reducing the risk of Alzheimer's. And one of the studies I talk about in Eat Smarter, the implementation of, it's like 2 to 3 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil a day, reducing the risk of Alzheimer's by, you know, 50, 60, 70%. And these are observational studies, so I'm not saying this is causation, but again, the researchers did a really good job accounting for other potential confounding factors. So that just, it tells me that this food really has a propensity towards supporting cognitive function. But with your olive oil, this is one of the most important things to be careful with what you're buying, all right? I've been to people's house and I'll see olive oil sitting on their counter in a plastic bottle, all right? In a clear bottle as well. Olive oil is photosensitive. And I don't think we realize this as well oftentimes. I know I didn't, that it's actually, there's a chlorophyll content in there. Kind of gives us this kind of greenish hue to
greenish.
It.
Yeah.
You know, so that chlorophyll is, it has that photosensitivity to it as well. It's one of the aspects. But anyways, being that it's photosensitive, light breaks it down and can accelerate oxidation and make the oil go rancid. So this is why you find olive oil most of the time, even if it's lower quality, in dark glass bottles, because it's protecting. This is how stuff has been done. Our ancestors figured this out a long time ago. We've got to keep this in a dark condition, and also putting it in glass, because also plastics photodegrade too. And so light breaks plastics down, but it can take, again, a couple centuries for, you know, a small amount of plastic to fully break down. But it's happening. Micro amounts are happening all the time when it's under light. If anybody's had the experience of leaving a plastic water bottle in a car,
right,
you know, and then having a sip, like you can taste the plastic, like it tastes funny.
It leaches in there.
Yeah. And so water's a solvent. So you're drinking a plastic tea, you know, but with these oils and some of the compounds in there, some of the acids, that can even exacerbate that breakdown of the plastic more. So we want to make sure that our extra virgin olive oil, extra virgin, so it's cold processed. And that tells you something else. Like, if this is cold processed, they do so much to keep it cool. Do I want to cook it? Maybe not. We can. And it is a safe oil, but it's low temperatures. Low temperatures. If we're going to use oil for cooking at higher heats, we want to use something more stable, saturated fats. The saturated fats, we're talking about the saturation of hydrogens on that, the chemical structure. And so it just makes it more stable. Whereas once we get into monounsaturated fats, we're having some spaces missed for those hydrogens, and it makes it a little bit more unstable. So now it has like a flex to it. Polyunsaturated fats are much more unstable, but we need all of these, right? So with olive oil, low temperature cooking, but mainly using it to make dressings, using it as a quote finisher. After you plate your dish, drizzle some olive oil on top, you know. Oftentimes, you know, if I make a salad, you know, I'll just, even if I have a salad dressing, you know, I get the good stuff. I'll even throw in an extra tablespoon of olive oil in there as well.
Besides just the health benefits, it's like I crave it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a couple, we'll link to one of the studies. There was one study out of Italy where researchers were giving people up to 1 liter of olive oil a week, right? Like a massive amount. Yeah. Somebody thinks like 1 liter of olive oil a week. And they found all these benefits. I don't have it on hand, you know, I don't want to pull it up on my computer right now, but we'll link to it over there. And you know, just to build on top of it, and there was a big book. I wanted to interview the author. I'm forgetting the name now, but he wrote about the sort of how dirty the olive oil industry is and have to be really careful, because a lot of olive oils are cut with you know, these hydrogenated seed oils that are out there. Right? Yeah. Canola oil or whatever. So shooting for, you know, the ones that have that, whatever certification you're looking for, that is making sure that this thing is pure. Because if you probably roll up to your normal grocery store, Ralph's, other stuff, there's probably a decent amount of olive oils. Even if they say extra virgin, they're cut.
They're making it into crack, basically.
They're making it into crack.
It's not just that pure. They've got this kind of crack version of their olive oils out there. And this is so true, you know. And then we get in that conversation about what happens when we consume those types of oils.
Right.
Right. And I've got these wonderful people in my life. Dr. Kate Shanahan is another one of those folks. She's one of the foremost experts in this topic of these highly refined seed oils. And now, it's not that these are inherently bad. I'm not saying that. When we have an extraction from, you know, a peanut oil or, you know, a macadamia nut oil. But what we are talking about here are things like rapeseed. We're talking about canola. We're talking about soybean oil that is marketed as vegetable oil, quote, vegetable oil. But that's not kale oil. It's not broccoli oil. It's manipulation and marketing. And I remember my family making that switch over and started frying French fries and fish and vegetable oil and thinking it's so much healthier. And again, for myself, 9 out of 10 people in my family, obesity, heart disease, diabetes, you name it, somebody's got something. And really, almost 10 out of 10 people, you know, including myself included, you know, I had this degenerative spinal condition when I was just a kid. I was 20 years old, but that was years in the making to have this advanced arthritic condition. The physician told me I had the spine of an 80-year-old man when I was 20. All right. And I, now when I hear that and I think about it, I'm just like, there's some 80-year-olds that are killing it out here that are doing great. You know, it's just what we've associated with aging, you know, in our culture today. And so anyways,
the seed oils.
Yeah. And having this experience where we're inundated with all these different seed oils today and thinking that it's healthier, this is a major problem. One of the primary journals, one of the top journals in inhalation toxicology, I cited in Eat Smarter, found that simply smelling seed oils while cooking can damage your DNA.
Dude, this is going to sound crazy, but growing up, you know, my family, they're vegetarian, and, you know, growing up and everything like that, we're from India, and everywhere you go over there, like, you know, I mean, here too, but it's all cooking with seed oils, right? It used to be coconut oil, other things like that, but now it's all seed oil, ghee. And then everybody was convinced that they came to America and this is the better way of doing it. Margarine, seed oils, other stuff. Let's get rid of the ghee and not cook with that anymore. And my mom growing up would make this dish. It's like a little flat bread, and it's called puri. It's like from the tradition in the region that I'm from in India, Gujarat. And you would kind of fry it. It's like a little fried bread that's there. And she would cook it downstairs and kind of fry it on Sundays. It was something that we'd have with like chai, and we'd have puri, like a little bit of bread and coffee in the morning, kind of our version of it. And when they would cook it, I'd be sleeping, you know, sleeping in on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And I'm in high school, middle school, and I would get the worst headaches Sunday when she would cook this. You know, downstairs, the windows are open, everything like that. But upstairs, hot air rises, and our whole house would be filled with these fumes from this vegetable oil that was there. And I'd wake up with almost like, not full on migraines. I didn't even know what migraines were back then, but like really severe headaches. And even still to this date, when I am in a place that doesn't have good ventilation, or if I go to a restaurant, we're meeting friends and they're not using the best oils that are there, I can see an impact, right, on my brain cognition and function. And it feels like a little bit of like my brain's being suffocated. Our brains naturally create cellular debris as we age. That's natural. It's part of the process. A healthy brain with the right anti-inflammatory and antioxidant systems in place, though, can clean up this debris using a process called autophagy. But when those systems become compromised through a variety of insults like insulin resistance, toxicity, lack of sleep, the debris piles up and neurodegeneration and inflammation result. Taking the right steps now, today, regardless of what age you are, can prevent and even reverse an inflamed brain. Thanks for tuning into this week's mini episode of the Drew Perrott Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, as always, consider sending it to a friend who might enjoy it as well, especially a friend who cares about the topic of brain health. Thanks for listening in. I'll see you next week.